Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire Radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Matt Gertz from Media Matters joins us to explain why you didn't need to read the El Paso shooter's screed. You could have just turned on Fox News. Investigative journalist David Dane will be here to discuss why Democrats are ignoring the power of the hospital industry to their own detriment. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to analyze all the news from this week. And we'll begin a new interview series on this week's show, where we speak to candidates who are running on progressive values against incumbents throughout the country. Our first interview will be with Shahid Buttar, who is looking to unseat Nancy Pelosi in California's 12th district. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show where you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio program commercial-free with access to over 10 years of archives. Go to ROFpodcast.com right now to sign up. Helping me run down a busy week in the news, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, obviously the news this week has been rightfully dominated by the two mass shootings and murders that we saw over last weekend. One in El Paso, Texas, involving a self-styled foe of immigrants and immigration and white supremacy or white supremacist who wrote a screed, and it explained why he decided to take a semi-automatic weapon and kill 20 people, injure two dozen. He was taken into custody, and then within 24 hours, maybe even 12 hours, we saw another mass shooting, this one in Dayton, Ohio, where nine people were dead, another two dozen or so injured. The shooter killed his sister. It's unclear yet as to why, what was his motivations, but he apparently did have a kill and rape list, according to people who went to high school with him 10 years ago. And so obviously both of them are at some baseline disturbed, but one is motivated by something that's quite clear, this white supremacy. Another we're not sure of at this point. There's been a lot of rumors about it, and I don't think until we get some more clarification. But we should also say later in the week, we also did hear that the Gilroy shooter at the Gilroy Garlic Festival in California was being investigated for under domestic terrorism because it turned out he had a kill list that apparently the authorities feel indicates that he was a political extremist. And it could very well be very similar to what we saw in El Paso. So we have two different issues here, right? We have the gun control issue because it gives people the lethal means to carry out their deed. And then we have the white supremacy issue, which is increasingly being a motivating factor in these killings. And they don't always end up being mass murders. They can be other, sort of hate crimes. But so we have two different issues here. And, you know, the gun control thing, I mean, I don't know. I mean, is that how you see it, Digby?
It is. And I actually think that there's an interesting sort of dynamic in exactly what you just said. We've had mass shootings for you know, the last decade has really seen a tremendous escalation in these events. There's been terrorism, you know, from Islamic extremists for a variety of reasons. There have been people with, you know, personal grudges. There have been workplace mass shootings, schools, churches, you know, for any number of motivations. And, you know, obviously the one that immediately comes to mind when you start talking about this is the Newtown massacre of those six-year-old babies by a young man who obviously had serious mental health issues, and he was able to get a hold of an automatic weapon and for reasons inexplicable went in and shot these little children. And at that was a moment, you know, that I think that everybody thought was going to be a watershed in this gun control issue. The idea of unfettered access to these, you know, killing machines came to the fore. I think everybody thought something had to happen. No civilized society could tolerate that sort of thing. It just seemed obvious. The president got behind it. The Republicans, they had 55 senators that were ready to vote for background checks and some other, you know, long-held, you know, needs for some kind of gun control. And the NRA, people thought they stayed silent for a good week or a week and a half after it happened. And then Wayne LaPierre came and gave a speech before the Washington Press Club, and he basically threw down the gauntlet. That's where he started talking about the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, and we need to arm teachers. And that's when that whole thing, and he just came out swinging. And Mitch McConnell followed in line. He filibustered the Senate bill for gun control, and that was the end of that. And, you know, it was stunning. It was a stunning show of political force with the NRA leading the way. But let's face it, Mitch McConnell didn't have to do that. But, of course, he is the top recipient of NRA money in the Senate. And he also truly believes in this because this is a source of tremendous power for the Republican Party. And, you know, for the next few years, we had more and more and more of these mass shootings. Just one horrifying massacre after another. And I think for me, I kept thinking, well, you know, at some point, this is, you know, the body count has got to have an effect here. You know, the NRA cannot continue to justify this. The Republicans can't keep running on it. It's absurd. And I thought after Las Vegas that where 600 people were wounded and, you know, 59 people were killed. And it was a bunch of country music fans who, you know, I can assume that many of them may have been Trump voters. They were in this public place out in the open, in Las Vegas, the premier tourist destination in the United States. And I just assumed that this was going to have to be the one that broke. And when it didn't, I think I lost a little heart. Something in me sort of snapped a bit. And I went, you know what? Nothing is going to happen until the Republicans are out of power altogether. Right. This is the only thing that will stop this is that. So I don't lay all of that at the feet of Trump. He is, of course, a primary, sort of recipient of the gun culture love. But the gun part of this, I feel, is definitely, this is a Republican problem. Now, the white supremacy part of this.
Well, hold on. Let's hold off on the white supremacy thing for a moment, because I think we should sit with this for a moment, because I think this is absolutely right. The problem that we have with guns, and let's also be clear here, we have 20 to 30,000 people who die every year because they kill themselves with a gun. And all of the research is completely clear on this. It's clear that killing yourself with a gun is far more lethal than any other way of killing yourself. It's clear that if you fail the first time to commit suicide, the chances of you actually committing suicide go way, 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 way down. But if you try and commit suicide with a gun, you're going to be 95 to 98% successful. So we know that it contributes. And we know that when you have longer waiting periods, when you have better background checks, the number of people who die by suicide goes down. We know all the data that we need to know about that aspect of it. And we know the same thing about in areas where there have been some type of gun reform. The number of guns don't necessarily diminish, but the lethality of the guns do, because it's harder for different people to get the guns. This is all true in the I couldn't agree with your point more on this. In fact, I was saying this all week on the Majority Report. The bottom line is, I cannot guarantee you some form of sensible gun control if the Democrats are in power, because who knows? It's likely, but who knows? And who knows to what extent the Supreme Court won't quash it. But the one thing that I can say with 100% surety is that as long as Republicans control either the presidency or one of the houses of Congress, we will get no type of gun control. We got to take a break. We'll talk about more of this on the other side. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio, here with Heather Parton. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So Heather, when we broke, we had basically talked about how there are two separate issues that are not mutually exclusive, but they're separate issues in terms of how we deal with them and where are the sort of the choke points for these issues. One is that came up this week. One is is gun control. And we made the point that this is not a Donald Trump phenomena. This is a Republican phenomena. The inability for this country, regardless of how many six-year-olds are killed, how many country Western music fans are killed, how many Latinos are killed at a shopping mall, how many revelers going out to a club are killed in Florida or in Ohio, or people in a movie theater, and how many people die by their own hand in committing suicide. These are all problems that can be laid on the right at the doorstep of Mitch McConnell, frankly, in the Republican Party, and we will never be able to deal with it until they do not have the ability to stop this legislation, which means that they cannot hold one of the two houses of Congress nor the presidency. The second issue is, of course, the white supremacy, and you wrote about that quite a bit in your second piece at Salon this week. Let's talk about that and how it plays into this culture of grievance.
Well, I think the one point I wanted to make about all this is that I think that I'm hopeful, maybe not hopeful is not the right word, but I feel like there may be a chance. This confluence of white supremacist ideology, terrorism, and the gun issue, all kind of, you know, surrounding Trump and the Republicans, it may end up you know, maybe that will bring this to a head. I mean, maybe I'm just being naive here, but it seems to me like there's something that happens when you see that it become explicitly political, as it was in El Paso, as it was with the Tree of Life Synagogue in Christchurch in New Zealand, and you're seeing this sort of ideology sort of coalesce around going in and shooting people. I mean, they're terrorists. Their method of terrorism is to use these automatic or semi-automatic weapons to kill mass numbers of people. And it strikes me, and I thought maybe that this would be a moment when you would see maybe some kind of recognition among the American people that something has actually shifted in a way that is even more dangerous than it was before. And it was already horrifying. The body count is absolutely horrifying. And to that extent, I think that Donald Trump, he is certainly encouraging, enabling white supremacy, but there's also something about his personality in general, which I think we can apply to this idea of grievance and vengeance. I mean, that is what he ran on. He ran on the idea that it's a violent world, and the only way that we can that we can survive it is to be violent in return. I mean, he said this over and over again, that he believes in an eye for an eye. He believes in getting even. This is his operating philosophy. And when you look at the profile, the personality profile of these mass shooters, they're 99.9% of them are men. Most of them are white. And most of them have this exact same, sort of operating philosophy. They are entitled. They feel that they've been unfairly treated, and they are out to get revenge. I mean, that is Donald Trump, and I think we have to start. You know, I'm not going to talk about toxic masculinity. I'm no expert in that particular thing. But I will say this: if such a thing exists, we have a president who is an avatar of that particular issue, from the misogyny to the racism to the sense of entitlement to the sense of grievance, and to the answer for that always being vengeance. He calls himself a, quote, counterpuncher, and he does it to every single day. He never lets a criticism go by without reacting. And I'm not saying that he's been physically violent. He hasn't been. But it's disconcerting to think of the most powerful man on earth having the same kind of personality profile as many of these people who feel they need to act out violently. I mean, this man has a tremendous amount of power. I closed my piece in Salon this past week in talking about this with, you know, a deep concern that Trump will decide he needs to get even with somebody, and he has the power to do it in ways that we don't even want to think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing on both ends of this, right? It's disturbing on the Trump end. It's disturbing on the general population end. I mean, I think largely what you are describing, this sense of grievance, the sense of entitlement, is really at the core of a conservative worldview. And it just feels like more and more of the Republican Party is getting closer and closer to that core. And that it does not bode well for the country, at least in the short and midterm. Hopefully it's okay in the long term, where it looks a little bit less rosy for the Republicans, but one can only hope. We got to take a break. Let's continue this conversation and talk more in the next hour. Digby, we'll see you then. In the meantime, we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio. Just ahead, David Dayen joins us to discuss the power of the hospital industry. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Fans of this show are certainly familiar with our next guest's investigative reports. This week, I want to discuss a few stories he recently published in the American Prospect, dealing with the hospital industry and the Federal Trade Commission. Here to discuss, investigative journalist extraordinaire Dave Dayan. So, David, looking back a couple of weeks ago, and this is a big issue in the context of the Democratic debate, and it's a big issue in the context of basically Democratic politics right now, and it should be. When we talk about the U.S. healthcare system, we're talking about, what, a fifth, a quarter of the economy, and it's broken, and people want it to work, and it came up in both the debates so far, or all four of the debates, I guess, is, I don't know how you want to calculate that. And everyone seems to have a fully formed or at least a plan that they can talk about. However, you made the point in your piece on the American Prospect that Democrats are ignoring one essential thing that you write will, if they continue to ignore, it will doom any meaningful reform. What are they ignoring?
They're ignoring the hospital industry and more broadly, the providers of health care. It's really strange. So you listen to these debates, and every time one of these candidates talks about the health care reform that is needed and the obstacles to progress, you hear about the insurance industry, and you hear about the pharmaceutical companies. And there's just this huge black hole that's missing there, which is the people who actually treat you, the doctors, the hospitals, the clinics, all of those groups who are not really a benign actor in this. I mean, I found it interesting that during the debates on CNN, during the commercials, there was one from the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which is this corporate group that is opposed to not just single payer, but really any reform to the healthcare system. And the primary funders of that are hospital groups, the American Hospital Association, the American Medical Association, and so on, a number of regional hospital groups as well. These are the people who are funding the ads wanting to stop reform, and Democrats won't talk about them. And it's very clear that the big problem in healthcare in America is that it costs too much. And the reason that it costs too much is that we have a concentrated set of actors within the provider industry who charge astronomical rates to pad their own profits. And the fact that that's invisible from this entire debate is really baffling to me, and it's a recipe for disaster in my view.
As I understand it, right, the idea, and we all have, you know, we have different variations of a Medicare for All plan, but let's just start with a Medicare for All plan that is actually Medicare for All and maybe arguably Medicaid for All, but that doesn't quite sell as much. But the point being that there's a single payer and, you know, predominantly. So the idea is that because there is one single payer of health care, that single payer will have negotiating power, will have access to data so they can make informed decisions as to what is suitable in certain situations, and that gets translated and communicated by what they're willing to pay for and not pay for and how much they're willing to pay for. And presumably, that's going to be the cost containment mechanism, right? Like, my understanding
that's
is
the
that
idea.
Well, that's the single payers are going to go to the doctors. I mean, we do hear like everything around it, right? Like the doctors are going to be happy because they're no longer going to have to deal with insurance, which I imagine from a provider standpoint is at least as much as a headache as it is from a consumer standpoint, patient standpoint. So why won't that control costs? What are they missing?
Well, the hospital industry has not sat back and thought, oh, well, I hope that never happens. I guess we shouldn't prepare for that. What they've been doing is really monopolizing various regional markets. I believe the statistic is that 90% of all metro areas have hospital markets that are highly concentrated. And so it's not like there's going to be a single force only on one side. It's going to be on both sides. There's going to be a single payer on one side, and there's going to be, practically speaking, a single provider on the other side. If you are in Pittsburgh, you're probably seeing a doctor with UPMC. If you are in San Francisco, you're probably seeing a doctor with Sutter Health. In Boston, I believe it's Partners Health. So, you know, they have leverage too. the providers can simply say, "Oh, you're only going to give me a Medicare rate. Well, good luck having any people in the city of Pittsburgh being covered by healthcare." And this isn't conjectural. Look at what happened in Washington State, where they decided to put together a public option. Now, initially, the public option was designed to go at very low reimbursement rates so that it would be affordable to the average Washingtonian, and it would create competition within the system. By the time the hospital industry got done with it, we were talking about a 160% of Medicare rate for that public option in Washington State. This happens over and over and over again. And we saw it during the ACA when the hospital industry was essentially bought off, and that's why we didn't get a public option. We've been here before, and not talking about the hospital industry, while understandable at some level, and we can talk about that, has not been a recipe for success in healthcare reform.
So if I understand, the idea is that the benefit that we would get from a single payer in their monopsony power that we would invest in the government, that is a monopoly buying dynamic, these hospitals are effectively creating single seller situations in each particular market. And therefore, we come in with our increased buying power and they say, well, now we have an increased power as a seller, because if you don't want to buy from us, everybody, we bought everybody else out. There's nobody else for you to go. And that's the dynamic you're talking about. So
that's right.
So, and when you say Democrats are not talking about it, I mean, really, the problem is they don't have a plan to deal with that.
Right. And it's not just the reimbursement rates. Like, that's not the only thing going on here. You're aware, I'm sure, of the surprise billing issue where, you know, you go to the emergency room, you have a radiologist or an anesthesiologist who happens to be out of network, or even the ambulance that got you there. You didn't know that because you're not shopping around when you're unconscious. And you get hit with a giant out-of-network bill. This surprise billing is very commonplace. And another example of an attempt to legislate it away, and right here in California, there was a bill that was put together to stop surprise billing. And by the time the hospital industry got done with it, it was so watered down that it was abandoned by its primary sponsors. This, you know, there's no real understanding of the issues within healthcare that are really driving up the costs. And they sit not necessarily with the insurance industry, they sit with the hospital industry. And, you know, you talk about pharmaceuticals, and pharmaceuticals has similar dynamics, but that's about 10% of all healthcare spending is on pharmaceuticals. When you're talking about hospitals, doctors, clinics, outpatient care, that's about 50%. So that's the driver here. And it needs to be taken really head on.
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the piece that you wrote about the FTC. That's fascinating. But I want to finish this up to just get a sense from you. When you say take it on head on, what does that mean? What would a proposal look like that would actually deal with that problem? I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back with David Dayan after this.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. Right now I'm talking to journalist David Dayan about his pieces on the hospital industry and the FTC. So, David, I want to get to your story in the American Prospect about the FTC, because we've seen a couple of instances in the past couple of weeks where the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, has been, I don't know, anemic, or I don't even know what to call it. I don't know if there's an adjective in terms of what they're doing. But before we do, I want to stay on the piece that you wrote about Democrats missing one huge, huge element that needs to be addressed in the context of healthcare reform in this country. And that is, we hear a lot about, dealing with the insurance companies, but you've made the point that the primary problem with healthcare in this country is its cost. Certainly the bureaucracy involved is also annoying, but the cost is the big element, and that the main driver of costs of healthcare in this country are the providers, the doctors and the hospitals in particular, or hospital groups, that are beginning to become heavily concentrated And therefore, in some respects, are hoping to make themselves immune from the buying power that would come with a single-payer system so that they could basically say, like, you may have a monopoly over your buying powers, a monopsony, but we have a monopoly over providing care. So, you know, that restaurant, Memorial South, we own it. We own Memorial North. So if you want to go get some health care, right, you got to come to us. So what if you were running for president, David Dayen, what proposal would you include alongside your single payer health care to address that? Or is it more just making the public more aware of it, or is it both?
I think it's both. We have to break up the concentrations of power in this medical industry, the medical industrial complex. From 1998 to 2018, there were over 1,600 hospital mergers, most of them that weren't even looked at because they fall under the threshold whereby the antitrust authorities have to look at them. I would eliminate that, particularly in healthcare, and look seriously at breaking up these concentrations of power. Surprise billing should be banned. It's ridiculous that somebody who is in no position to shop around to find somebody in their network gets hit with these surprise bills. The uninsured should not be charged 10 times the cost of care that insured people are. Prices should be transparent, which is something actually the Trump administration is trying to do to a small degree, and the hospital industry is squealing about it. That's another danger here. You have Trump getting to the left of Democrats on health care with that particular provision, looking for transparency in prices at hospitals, which you pretty much can't get right now. So there are policies that can be taken, but I think the awareness is just as important.
First place to start.
And as I said, you know, I get it. Doctors are the people that heal you. Insurers are the companies that hassle you and try to restrict your care. It's an easier villain to depict the insurance industry or the drug companies than it is hospitals and doctors. But that approach has not worked historically in healthcare. The power of the hospital industry, the power of the medical industry has prevailed by and large. And so we need a different approach, and we need a set of policies that would actually limit that power so that a future reform of the healthcare system can actually be effective.
I mean, so from a rhetorical standpoint, we got to make the point, too, that I guess what you're saying is that hospitals are price gouging because they can.
Without question.
And they're trying to set themselves up to price gouge even when there's a single payer. All right. Well, look, we only have about 4 minutes left. So I want to get to this story about the FTC. There's really a couple of them. But a week or two ago, I saw that Facebook got a huge fine. And then I realized they don't care. And all they cared about was just making sure that Mark Zuckerberg didn't have to testify. And so there's more to that story. It's ridiculous.
It's completely ridiculous. The director of the Division of Enforcement, the associate director, I should say, a guy named James Cone, who put this settlement together, admitted during the public announcement of this fine, which was $5 billion, that the FTC got more money that they would not have otherwise in exchange for not going further, for not forcing Zuckerberg to testify, for dropping the case. Now, Sam, I believe that we have a name for that, and it's the name is bribe. You're basically having Facebook say, we will give you more money if you end this case, and the FTC saying yes and announcing it publicly that this is what they did. I'm shocked that this isn't a bigger scandal.
I mean, you can't just go in. I mean, there's something wrong with the FTC that they don't want to investigate. Now, why don't we have congressional hearings on this?
Well, I mean, we are having hearings about big tech, right, through the House Judiciary. But I think the FTC itself needs to be scrutinized. And in fact, this week, or in the past several days, a progressive group called Demand Progress has called on the FTC to investigate the FTC. and let me explain why. So the other big settlement that the Federal Trade Commission made was with Equifax, who
yep.
we know had a data breach. 147 million people had their personal information exposed to all. And they did this settlement that the top line figure was $700 million. One of the things in the settlement they said was, well, you have two choices. If you were affected by this, you were one of the 147 million, you can go to this website, you can either get this 10-year credit monitoring service, or we'll give you $125. You pick, right? After the first week of this website being up and the claims coming in, the FTC changed their mind and said, well, we only had $31 million earmarked for cash payments, and too many of you are asking for the $125. So really, you should go for the 10-year credit monitoring. It's much better. Now, what that actually is deceptive advertising. I mean, the FTC came out, said, here, you can take $125, and then they changed that a week later. The agency that has jurisdiction over deceptive advertising is the FTC. So this is an agency that doesn't even really treat the victims of things under their control any better than the crooked telemarketers who they're supposed to bust. And
well,
so Demand Progress said that, you know, they put this thing at failedtradecommission.com, where you can demand that the FTC investigate the FTC, issue immediate cease and desist order to itself, and prohibit itself from making future deceptive statements.
Well, people can check that out. I'm going to go there right now. David Dayan, always a pleasure.
All right, thank you.
David Dayan is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He's also the executive editor of the American Prospect. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Don't forget ROFpodcast.com to check out our membership show.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see. Painted faces fill the place.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.